You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
This one is called Ndikhokele. It is a live version. Let's go to church just a little bit on a business show, right? Let's go to church. That's what we do right here. Business Sense on Adventist World Radio. We are powered by SID Media. In the background there, it is Ndikhokele. This one is coming from Ubhuti Usbu Noah, and it is the live version of this particular song. Yes, sorry to do that to you, but we'll of course bring you the full version later on. We need to jump into a conversation with Mr. Matabane, who I believe is already on the line. But before we talk to him, it is important that I remind you that you can get in contact with us by actually using these details if you do have a question for him.
Be part of the conversation. Send us a WhatsApp message on +27 73 470 3520 or call us at +27 12 001 7679. Let your voice be heard. Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media, from broadcast to baptism.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Now, on Thursdays, we've got this thing called the Shapeshifter, which is a very important segment and a growing segment for that matter. And this is where we bring you some leading people in industry, in business, in academia. They can be anywhere in the continent of Africa as they do their job. Like we said, we really enjoy having those conversations with such people just to get a sense of who is the person behind the person. And my Shapeshifter this evening is Mr. Matabane, who is the CEO of the Black Business Council, which is the overarching federation that represents black professionals, business associations and chambers. Now, the primary purpose of the Black Business Council is to lobby government on policy-related matters and to play an advocacy role where policies are in place in order to accelerate the participation of black business in the mainstream economy. And he joins me on the line this evening. Mhlekazi, good evening.
Good evening, Tabelo, and good evening to the listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
We can only try.
Yeah,
but I'm doing okay.
That sounds very deep.
I think we should try and make a difference wherever we are.
I love that.
The trying part of it.
I love that.
Yes, and then, as you said, we are in the politics of business and,
yeah.
and not in the politics of politics.
Yeah. Must be a difficult space to maneuver, the politics of business.
Yeah, it's extremely, extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Because just like any other environment, when you are trying to get the help,
yes,
to empower those who don't have,
yeah, yeah,
the have will always want to hoard,
yeah,
whatever they got, through legal means or illegal,
yeah,
means,
yeah,
they're not going to give it for free. And we've learned in the past 29 years,
yes,
that's, and this that's is a difficult struggle.
I envy your position, but I don't envy it at the same time. I'm sure that it gives you heart palpitations sometimes, and you sometimes sleep at night and never have to wake up. So it must be very difficult. But we do hope that, you know, with the work that you're doing, which you rightfully said is about making impact, especially for those communities that have the have-nots, who don't have access to, I suppose, what the haves have access to. But thank you so much for joining us this evening. We really appreciate it. Shapeshifter, Mr. Matabane, is here where we talk to the person behind the person. And sometimes it's, you know, from the fact that people watch you from afar. They see you in the media. They see you in interviews. They see you in all this space. But some might be wondering, how do I even get to be where he is? And of course, the very important question that we ask right here on Business Sense is your relationship with mine. But before we even unpack all of that, let's go back a little bit, Mr. Matabane. When people say, please describe yourself where you might have to, I don't know, there's perhaps a few places. I'm sure everyone knows you by now. But when you are asked to go to, who's Mr. Matabane, what do you say?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. And because you become something, but
yeah,
you have gone through a lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, I think I see myself as a ruralist, someone from the rural areas.
Okay.
Who struggled to be like where we are, but I'm sure the story is not that much different from other black people. It will differ in degrees, because the struggle is never going to be 100% the same. It can be similar, but
yeah,
it won't be the same. So I grew up in Limpopo, in a rural area, in a village called Maguru.
Okay.
And I went to school like other kids.
Yeah.
When I did matric during those days, because those of us were born in the 70s. During those days, the careers that black people knew about was being a teacher.
Yeah.
Being a nurse.
Yeah.
Being a police person, and the prominent ones amongst them was being a doctor. They were like a few doctors, and then those were like the middle class of that time.
Yes.
And the doctors were the richer part of the middle class.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like all of us, I didn't have even any money to go to school. I had to use the language that has been used now. I had to hustle myself around that. I remember I completed matric and I stayed home for 2 years. And then the third year I became a teacher, but what they called a temporary teacher for a year. So I saved that money for that year, then I got admitted to now called TMG, but it's the one in Harangue. At that time it was called Supravelo Technical. And then I was admitted there, my money could only last for 6 months. So I made sure when I got there, then I passed. And since then I've been getting bursaries from that time. And,
sure.
And as they say, everything now is history. So I now also then worked during weekends. We used to do stock takings, and so that at least one could raise money. And I became a student assistant. I used to assist students who were doing end user computing, and I even work during weekends in Johannesburg at the shop, clothing shop. And so I used to be an assistant during the Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
In the Friday in the evening, so we used to knock off at 10 o'clock. Sometimes you don't have a transport, you have to walk like 10 kilometers to rest. But I think one thing I learned, especially when I worked at where we were selling, it was not the only clothing, we were selling other things. So it was a retail company, and they taught us customer service to say when someone comes into the shop, you must not judge them how they look and how they're dressed. You need to give them the attention that they need, because majority of the time you find that the people who have money don't dress like they have it. Sometimes the ones who don't have money will dress like they have money. So that helps you to treat people equally, I think, even now. And one thing I did when I realized that those who were poor could not afford to go to town to do career guidance, I then organized career guidance for the kids at school in my village. I did that thing, I think, for like 5 years, where I'll call all the institutions of higher learning and they will come to the village, and at least then the kids could not be spending money to try and get career guidance. And I think it was effective also. But that also teaches you some leadership skills and how to engage with people, how to communicate with people, especially strangers, people you've never known before, and how to build relationships that last long. So as they say again, the rest is history.
The rest is history.
And other things. But I think those for me were significant things that shaped my journey and where I am today. They always get used as a reference point.
Okay, now that's interesting. End user computing, I must tell you that it's one of those things that I didn't like, because it's almost like we're all, I suppose, if you can't go to school, the next best thing you can do is end user computing. But I'm glad that the world today has exposed a lot of young people to other options as well. But for us, it was almost the first thing you do, in end user computing, because we're trying to understand what computers are and what do they do. You spoke about the village, growing up in the village. What is the one or two socioeconomic challenges that you remember were prominent in your village?
Yeah, I think the big thing was that there were always a lot of people who didn't even have food. So access to many things was not there. Obviously, there was no electricity at that time. But one thing that was sort of working, even if people were not earning a lot of money, people were employed. That time, and we used to have, because we're in a bounty stamp called Lubwa, then they were like what we call now, they call industrial parks. So next to any township there'll be, and then village there'll be industrial parks where people, even if they were earning little, but they were at least they were working. And it happens, I think, if you go all over the place, in Northwest, there were a lot of them. I think even here in Gauteng, there are a lot of those that are not, at the moment, they are not used. They were abandoned, but there were many in the homeland. So people were at least busy. Unlike now, where we've got more than 50%. I think in the village there, I think we probably got like 70% unemployment. So even crime was a little bit less compared to now.
Okay. And how have those then, I suppose, influenced you into the person that you now are? Because I'm sure with such issues in the community, you were not prone to them, right? And in some way, you're also affected. But that could send any young person down a rabbit hole and they never come back because the environment where they are born and where they stay is not conducive. How has that affected you and shaped the person that you are? Or you are an optimistic by nature?
Yeah, I think the thing that the biggest role that was played by someone was by my mother. I think.
Mm, okay.
Even though she was poor, we were poor, mm. and she was like working as a domestic worker,
mm.
but she always liked education.
Mm.
So I'm sure the other kids. They would have gone the same route with the other kids,
mm.
Where we became nothing. But I think the role of the parents is very important.
Mm.
To me, but you were struggling, but education is the only thing that can get us out of this struggle.
Mm.
So I guess if it was not for her, because I remember when I was doing what is now called grade 10.
Yeah.
Because she was so struggling, and as I said before, it was relatively easier to get some jobs, mm. odd jobs, mm. that time.
Mm.
So when I was doing grade 10, I said to her, because I see you're struggling, we're also struggling, mm. maybe I should leave school and go in and do some odd jobs so that I can help you,
yeah.
to support the kids, because remember, we we are 8 at home, so I've okay. got 7 siblings.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the struggle. But mm. she says, no, you are not leaving school.
Mm.
Struggling as we are, education is important.
Yes.
And I think that is the one that shaped me and also saved me.
Mm.
Because then a lot of people that we went to school with, because of the environment, you have to work like 10 times harder than any other person.
Yes.
I remember the first time when I came to Johannesburg, because at school where I started, I could not finish the second year because it was part of Butatwana, mm. and then they wanted to start a penalty which I didn't have.
Mm.
And I went to best technical, now it's called part of UJ.
Yeah.
And we were writing aptitude tests to be admitted,
mm.
On a computer, and I had never seen a computer in my life,
mm.
so I had to try and switch on the computer,
yeah.
Before I can even understand the question.
Yeah.
I think if it was not for my mother, I would have been something else.
Sure, we thank the mother. There's already a comment saying, yeah. Hugh, let me prepare a cup of tea. This conversation is off to an interesting start. So there you go. Off to an interesting start. And yeah, to our listeners, you can do the same. +27734703520 is the WhatsApp number that you can use to send us your comments or your questions. Now, I want us then to go to your working history. And you've already alluded yeah. to some of the places that you've worked to at the shops. You've learned customer service and all those sort of stuff. And today you are the CEO of the Black Business Council. Is there a particular job when you look back, you're like, this prepared me for what I'm doing today?
Yeah, I think being a teacher also prepared me for this, because I had to do a lot of things, but also you educate people, because the job I do now, you have to educate a lot of people about the importance of economic transformation.
Mm.
That if we don't transform, the same democracy that we have may be gone very soon, because the majority of people may decide one day to say, no, let's surrender this country and government.
Mm.
So that helped me. Working at a shop, retail shop as well, helped a lot. But I also worked at the mine when apartheid was ending. So.
Mm.
I remember I was like the only black person there, the rest were African.
Sure.
And then we agreed, and that's why I don't drink coffee anymore. So we used to make each other coffee. I think we're like five. We used to make each other coffee because I was working in the administration in the finance department.
Yeah,
and then we are making coffee, having tents. So one day, as I was it was my turn to make coffee. There were like some black people coming to help and to look for help in the finance department. So they see me.
Yeah.
They see me delivering my tea. That was my turn to deliver the tea to the white people. And they said, "Oh, we think you are here working as a professional hand. You are making tea for white people."
Yeah.
And then I stopped. I stopped that day.
Never did it again.
I stopped drinking coffee from that day. Because let me stop drinking, because if I continue,
you're going to be serving.
I'm going to tell other blacks. But because they didn't see when the white people were bringing tea to me.
So they had one-sided view of things.
So that type of environment also, I think, they because we were the first group of black professionals. It also prepared me for the tough environment that we're facing even now.
I see. That's interesting. That's how far back. I mean, you spoke about the issue of transformation there, and I think it's a very important one for not only the South African market and economy, but for the rest of the economy as well. And sitting at the helm of the Black Business Council, what type of conversations are you guys having about such things?
Yeah, I think the challenge with transformation, and when you look at the South African market, so the South African corporates, they take a cue from the political administration. So if you look at different administrations, if you look at the President Mandela administration, I think that was the honeymoon phase, where Nelson Mandela had to try and unite the country. He has done his part. And then President Mbeki came, and then President Mbeki is the only person so far who made sure that there was economic transformation. I think he was very deliberate that I want to create a black middle class. I want to create black business. Because if you look at the people who've got money now, all the billionaires, you can name them, and the billionaires, they were created during the Thabo Mbeki's time. We've never had any other a time. Because when, for example, I remember the big companies that were resisting transformation when Thabo Mbeki was time, during Thabo Mbeki's time. And he had to write them letters and had to deal with them in public and force them to appoint even black people. And because the corporates then realized that this is the direction where we're going. They were buying into transformation. But unfortunately, after that, we've never had an administrator who is very clear on economic transformation. So we've been actually moving backwards. We've been regressing as far as transformation is concerned, because the corporates, and as I said before, those who have, they are not going to give for free. They are not going to give without a fight. But you need the political will from the top to keep on reminding them that no, you benefited unfairly, so you have to give extra than now, because now what is happening, the corporates are just doing as little as they can, and then they want to gain BE points, so they're just doing ticking boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but unfortunately, it goes back to the political will and the political administration, because unfortunately, corporates respect political administration because they are the ones who come with laws.
Yeah, true, true. Sure.
So if you don't have the right person, then you know the whole project it will fail. Because, for example, this year is supposed to be a very, very important year for economic transformation. It's 20 years of the Economic Empowerment Act. It's 25 years of Employment Equity Act.
Yeah.
So you have expected government to be punting this, doing a review and of the legislation and how effective the legislation has been. Unfortunately, there's no political will.
Sure.
We're sitting where we are. And I think, unfortunately, the white business has even become more bolder. Because they realize how we are in heaven.
Not going anywhere. Yeah.
If you check, for example, the beneficiaries of Black Economic Empowerment, it will have been a big white business over the next 29 years, more than Black business.
Sure. That's interesting. And I mean, I've had the privilege of working in EST for the last 10 years or so. And I can certainly tell you that what you're saying is absolutely true, right? And we're having to bend and we're adding a B and then we're adding another E and then we realize let's take out the E and it just becomes a whole lot of things. There's no clear political will on transformation and where we want to be going. And some of us who are sitting down here who are in EST, I mean, every day we see this thing happening every day. And yeah, we get to see a lot of beneficiaries that aren't supposed to be benefiting from BEE, but because they've found a way to work the system, they are benefiting from there. As the CEO then in your position, what is the one challenge that every day when you get to the office you're thinking, shucks, this is a lot?
I think that the bigger issue, and I think Steve Biko spoke about it a long time ago, is the lack of Black unity.
Black unity.
And I think white people have figured it out that if you want to conquer anyone, you must divide people. Black people, and I think that it's not only South Africa, it's all over the world. Blacks are very disunited. Because if you look at the numbers, we've got the numbers. And with the numbers, we should be dictating transformation by just buying power. If we decide, for example, today, if we're united, we decide today that we're not going to buy from a certain shop, a certain retailer, they will immediately change because they will feel it in the pocket. If we decide we're not going to bank at a certain bank, we pull all our money the following day and they will feel it because we are the majority. But we are just majority in numbers. Everything else, we are the minority.
Yeah.
So if we can be united, because once we are united, we'll be able to like each other.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, we don't like each other. We are full of jealousy. If I see Tapelo driving a Ferrari, and I see a 18-year-old white person driving a Ferrari, I'll be praising the white person to say, no, he works very hard. But with Tapelo, I'm going to be, the first thing that comes to Black people's mind is that he must have stolen the money.
Yeah.
So we really need to love each other and love ourselves.
Yeah.
And, but that starts from unity. If you are not united, where we are. To give you an example, when Eskom had Black CEOs, the white media, the white CEOs would be on the white people would be on their case. But when it was the white CEO,
there
the white people
no
were defending.
Yeah.
They were defending him, and he even contacted some Black people to defend him. While they only have electricity, so we are defending someone, but it's no electricity.
Yeah,
sure. So unfortunately, if and I don't have a solution, but if Blacks can just be as united as the Jews are, as united as the Muslims are, we will be far.
Mm.
We will be far. And because we'll stop being jealous. If I know this is this is Muloi restaurant.
Yeah.
And most of the people, if they're black, they're going to stop buying there. Because there's a jealous noise, it's going to do better than us.
Yeah.
But the Muslim, if they know this is their brother's company, they can even drive from here to Rustenburg to buy a car because they're supporting their own.
Yeah. True.
So if we can at least even have 10% of unity, it would be very far.
It would be very far. Sure. Just 10%. That's a huge, well, it's a small margin, but yeah, like you're saying, because we are so disunited, that's huge. Let's talk about you then as a leader. What motivates you as a leader?
I think firstly is to when I see people developing, people becoming better than they were yesterday.
Mm.
I always try and give people opportunity, and then that I think makes me is a motivator to say at least I've made a difference, and also being at the BBC to be able to help a black businesses because on a daily basis we get a lot of complaints about the black businesses being mistreated by government, being mistreated by white business, being mistreated by big business. So we just, at least when you see someone who's been who hasn't been paid for the past year, and you intervene and then they get paid, it makes you feel better.
It makes you feel better.
So I think it's more about other people being. Other people's problem being solved and helping other people. I think probably again it comes from being a teacher, helping other people to be better. That I think is shaped me to be where I am.
Ah, that's lovely. That's lovely. That Ubuntu is a beautiful thing. We're running out of time, but let's get to you and money now. How would you describe your relationship with money?
Yeah, I think this type of things, they come with experience.
And again, unfortunately,
because we did not have role models when we grew up. So you learn on the street. So there are certain decisions, for example, that I shouldn't have made. For example, I remember the first townhouse I bought.
Yeah.
I sold it, I think, after like 3-4 years. And looking back, I think I sold it. Because it's worth so much now. I may not even afford it. But I think I'm not a spendthrift. The car I'm driving is like, what, a 10-year old car. But you have to first transform to a state where you can withstand pressure, you can withstand peer pressure. Until you can withstand peer pressure, then you'll always try to as they say to match or try to catch up with the Joneses.
And
that is very difficult because you don't know what they do at night when they're sleeping.
Exactly.
So I will sort of define myself as a conservative person.
Okay.
When it comes to money. And I think also maybe growing up poor, you are always running away from poverty. You always calculating to say, if I've got 5 rands, these 5 rands must last me for so long. In case something doesn't work out, I should still be able to survive.
And
now when interest rate goes up by 2%, you should still be able to survive.
Yes, Yes, yes. That's very, very important. Let's talk about the family then. Do you teach the family about money and what they should or shouldn't do? I mean, you alluded to, for instance, selling your first townhouse when you realize, I should have held on to that thing because today it's worth far much more. I mean, that could be one of the lessons that you've learned around money. What do you say to the family?
It's a difficult balance because the balance between raising a family and working and doing the job I do is always a challenge.
Mm.
I try like one thing I do, I always the kids, I always take them to school in the morning because in the morning I'm there. They are coming, I may not be there, but since they started school.
Yeah.
I do try and sit down with them and we discuss money. To say that you need to save, like for example now with the kids who are in school, we agree that if you get certain grades per term, you'll get so much money. And that is your money, then you must use it for your own things. So try to get them to manage money at an early age. So that in future when they start working or having their own businesses, if they get a lump sum, they must not be surprised and now they want to run and buy expensive clothes and all those things, trying to impress. So I try to tell them, even to say that you don't have to change a car if you don't have to. If the car is still working, why change it? You can take that money off the car and save it and maybe buy a property with that money so that you can save for the future.
That's interesting. In fact, if I heard you very well, you're saying you are driving a 10-year-old car, being the president and the CEO of the Black Business Council. That's an interesting thing. When you drive into the office with a 10-year-old car, you don't feel pressure at all.
No, I don't, because I think you have to be in love with yourself. Because if you are in love with yourself, and you are known as yourself, and I don't think people will have issues. I'm sure people will have their own perceptions, but probably they are thinking this one is very stingy.
Yes.
He can afford the car, but he doesn't want to buy it.
Yes, exactly.
That would be fine.
Exactly.
But at least I know if I want to go out for dinner, I can go anytime.
Anytime.
I don't have to say I'm waiting for the end of the month.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so you need to try and make sure that you don't overcommit.
Yes.
Once you overcommit, the Reserve Bank comes and says 1% increase. You start to hate the Reserve Bank.
No, we do.
Do their job.
We do. I mean, if you hear a lot of South Africans, when the governor comes, like, "Hey, he's back again," you know. Well, he's doing his job. We are the ones who got ourselves into trouble. He's just doing his job, and you are quite right. Yeah. That's what he's doing.
Yeah, because there's a difference between qualifying for a car
and affording
or a loan and affording it.
Yeah.
You can qualify for 10 million loan, but can you afford to service it? And also, for example, when you own a car, for example, there's a what you call total cost of ownership.
Yes.
It's not only the installment. Let's say the installment is 5,000. You need to pay insurance. You need to take it for service if it's out of motor plan. Even if it's not out, you hit a pothole there, the tire needs to be replaced. The technology, the petrol goes up. What do you do? Do you park the car at home and walk to work? But if you overcommit, those things happen. Because the bank told you, you qualify for a 10 million loan, then you say bring it.
Bring all of it.
Will you be able to afford to repay? Because the banks are not charity.
They're not.
They're there to make money.
Exactly. I love that point that you made, that there is a difference there. We've got about 3 minutes, Tata Madan, but I want to ask this question. In this 3 minutes or less, if you were to go back, what is the one thing that you would do differently?
It's very difficult, but I think the one thing that I would do differently, I think I would have tried to study and finish school much earlier, because I just did 4 or 5 years ago I did the MBL.
Yes.
Now I'm thinking of doing a PhD, but because of the business, it becomes a difficult thing to do. But I think I could have done it earlier, when I still have time. By now, at least I would have completed or almost about to complete. So, but I still have to find time and do it within the very same thing, because it's also important to always even plan what you do post retirement. You need to have a plan. You can't then say, no, I've retired and I'm sitting at home and doing nothing.
Yeah.
You need to still have your brains being kept busy. And if you've got a doctorate, PhD, you can always do other things. And
yes.
Do some part-time lecturing there and do this and say, I could have done it earlier, but I still have to do it.
You still have to do it. That's beautiful. Any last thoughts to, I suppose, people who follow you, to your fellow colleagues in business and at the Black Business Council as well, and some young people that are looking up to you? What would be your last words to them?
Yeah, I think two things. The first thing is always be on time. I've left some meetings where someone requests a meeting with you, and they tell you like 5 minutes before, 5 minutes after the meeting should have started, that they are running 10 minutes late. So I usually leave those type of meetings.
Okay,
because it means you don't take the other person seriously.
Yes.
So it's important that we are on time. We respect time. We are known, especially as Black people, we are known as people who don't respect time at all. And then the second thing, I think it's important to network. Because when you network, then you develop a relationships where you have sponsors. And what is called a sponsor? The role of sponsors is to talk on your behalf when you are not there.
Yes.
So whether you're in business or you are working in a corporate, you need people who can then give you testimony, positive testimony about you in your absence. Because some of the things, the decisions are taken without you. People just use their own perceptions and say, no, Tatolo is like this. There's this opportunity, but we don't think he's a reliable person. And then that's it.
Exactly. That's
so if you don't have people who are in powerful positions who will talk on your behalf, you have lost the opportunity. So even now, I still have mentors. I meet with them time permitting, sometimes once a year, once in 6 months, just to have a discussion to say, but how do you see this thing? And mentors, ideally, must be people who have achieved more than you, because they can tell you the truth.
Yes.
Otherwise, when you have a yes men or yes women, they are never going to tell you the truth. Because they see you as a better person or someone who has achieved more than them. So it's always important to surround yourself with people who have achieved more than you. They'll be honest with you. If you are doing things that are out of order, they will tell you.
That you're out of order.
Singing praises.
Yeah, sure. I've noted those two things beyond time and also network. Ralebogo, it was a great pleasure talking to you. I do know that there's lots to still unpack. If you do allow us next time to trouble you, we'll trouble you once again for part two on this one. But thank you so much for taking time this evening to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And
Ralebogo. That was, of course, our leader there, and Ntate Matabane, who is the CEO of the Black Business Council, as he talks to us about his journey, his career, life, and where he is today. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.